Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. I'm not a surfer, but I grew up in Southern California and had the great good fortune to spend a lot of time living at the beach along the beautiful Malibu coast in the 1960s and early 70s, before it became the exclusive enclave of the rich and famous. My sister and her husband taught me how to be safe in the surf, and I remember watching my brother-in-law surf and seeing that he was a master of the waves. I've loved watching surfers ever since, and I'm fascinated by their culture. And it isn't the cliche laid-back stoner persona that some think of. These people risk their lives riding big waves. They are bonded by a deep love of the ocean, and they tend to be very smart and in incredible shape. You have to be to survive riding a mountain of water. So let's paddle out into the swells, shall we? Later on, we'll hear a conversation between our oceanographer and big wave aficionado, Bill Patzert, and one of the deans of California sports writing, Bruce Jenkins, from the San Francisco Chronicle. Then we'll hear from Surfer Magazine staff photographer, Frank Cuarte. While towing his cameras out into the giant swells at places like Mavericks near Half Moon Bay, Frank also tows a sled behind his jet ski to save the lives of surfers before they're pinned beneath the maelstrom of whitewater. But first, let's talk to a big wave surfer who also has turned his love of science into the website StormSurf. Mark Sponsler helps use modern technology to predict when the best waves will break in an effort to educate and support surfers. Mark has surfed the massive break at Mavericks. He joined us from his home via Skype. Mark Sponsler, welcome to Blue Dot. First of all, I'd like to know about you a little bit. When did you first start surfing? When did you pick up the surfing bug?
Oh, probably when I was about 10 years old, lived in Florida, in Miami of all places, didn't have a surfboard, but I was watching other people surf, and I had a styrofoam surfboard, and so I tried surfing on that and snapped a couple of them real quick, and then eventually graduated up to a real surfboard.
And when did you start surfing bigger waves than what you found generally in Florida?
Actually, while I was living in Florida, I hooked up with a guy named Matt Keckley, who's, if you know, has been a pro, been around a long time, was on the tour for a while, and great surfboard shaper. And he and I and a couple of buddies said, let's go to Hawaii. So we went to the North Shore back in 92 or something like that. I don't remember exactly. And first trip there, scored some small Waimea, and it was great. And that's when I really got the bug. I was way undergunned, but it was just four of us surfing. Basically, it was large pinballs, minimal inside Waimea. And we surfed like 4 hours, just three or four of us. And it was great. You know, I just had to have it after that. I was addicted.
Was there ever like a first wave you rode that was really big, where you kind of wondered, I may be in over my head. What have I gotten myself into? Have you ever had that kind of feeling?
Yeah, when I was younger in Florida, believe it, of all places, when it would get big, by big, I mean 2 feet overhead. It was often just, I don't know, I'm scared. But back in those days too, we didn't have cords either. So if you ate it, if you got hit by a big white water and let go of your board, you had to swim the whole way in. And so, you know, I was a little kid. It was scary. But looking back at it now, it's kind of laughable.
I'd like to get some insight from you as a surfer. What makes a really good wave to surf? I know there's lots of different ones. For example, I grew up in Malibu, and those waves were really fun and easy to surf. They seemed that way to me. What is it that makes a wave that's really a surfer's dream?
So for sure it takes two main things. You got to have surf, right? And by surf, I mean you got to have a swell, not just a wind swell, but a ground swell, which means you have to have a storm and a setup where there's, you know, a storm will generate waves. The waves will travel over some distance before they reach your shore, and it gives them a chance to kind of even out and groom themselves out into long lines. And then the second part of it is you have to have bathymetry, some sort of setup on the ocean bottom to enable the wave to break you know, in a surfer's ideal dream, which would be, you know, a long peeling right or a long peeling left or, you know, whatever it might be, versus a just some beach break, or not even a beach break, but just some shelf where the wave comes in and closes out and is basically not rideable at all.
Okay, I want you to explain some terms for us, okay? Because you're talking to some Valley Cowboys here. Explain what a right and left curl is and what a closeout is.
Okay, so waves from a surfer's perspective are best when they don't break all at once. Like when if you look at a wave from right to left, left to right, and it just all breaks at one time, that's called a closeout. And basically all you can do from a surfer's perspective is you can drop down and get a drop in. But after that, if the wave breaks, you can't make any distance, any headway on the open face of the wave. And then the ride tends to be rather short. The ideal is to have an open face on a wave, and that means it either breaks steadily from left to right or right to left. And all that's driven, of course, by the bathymetry or what's going on underneath the surface of the water.
And tell us about the different kinds of surfboards. Like, for example, if you're riding smaller waves and you just want to be able to, you know, carve it and make lots of maneuverings, what kind of surfboard is that compared to when you're riding these monster waves, like you're interested in riding at a place like Mavericks or Waimea or, you know, the North Shore of Hawaii? What are the different kinds of boards that surfers use? Give us kind of a 101 on that.
Sure. So at the most basic level, if you're just learning to surf, most people start out on a longer board, something 8 feet, 9 feet long, 22 inches wide, a lot of foam in it. And it could be a soft top, too. It might not even be a regular hard fiberglass board. Those kind of boards give you lots of stability, lots of flotation, make it very easy to stand up and get the first thrill of surfing. But at some point in time, you start progressing and you realize that with that much board, you can't turn it very easily. And it becomes extremely difficult to paddle out and actually catch waves if the waves have any size and they're breaking, you know, regularly coming towards you, because you have to be able to duck dive the board, get underneath the white water, that is, to get outside to actually catch a wave. So then you start getting into a shorter board, maybe a 7 foot board. And then if you start getting better, then you start getting down into the 6 foot range board, or if you're really good, even in the upper 5 foot range board. The trick is, though, the shorter the board, the less foam, the better your balance has to be, the more accomplished you have to be at actually riding, getting up and doing maneuvers. And you also have to be a stronger paddler because there's less foam and you just got to muscle your way out on those short boards.
And what about the big wave boards? What do the surfers use when you're surfing a mountain of water like at Mavericks?
Sure. At Mavericks, the general standard board is 10 feet long, 20 to 22 inches wide, 3.5 inches thick. So it's a much larger board, and it's very, we'll call it pinned out, very racy, not a wide nose, not a wide tail. You need, basically, it's a rocket, and you're trying to use that to muscle your way into these giant waves. But then once you get up, you need to be able to turn the board, and the boards are designed specifically for that. A lot of paddle power, a lot of maneuverability, a lot of stability at speed.
Can you tell us about what it's like to ride that break at Mavericks? What is that wave like compared to other waves you've ridden?
So Mavericks is probably, you know, one of the top, I'll call it, two waves in the world between Mavericks and Jaws. Very, very, you know, using a snow skiing analogy, it's a triple black diamond, death drop kind of wave. If you haven't been other places riding large surf, you don't just paddle out at Mavericks and go, here's my first day at riding large surf. You know, you want to go to maybe Ocean Beach off of San Francisco on a good, you know, 10 to 15 foot day and be very comfortable in that and be able to catch waves before you would ever want to consider paddling out to Mavericks or Jaws. And the reality is the people that surf Mavericks and Jaws, you're talking the top 1% of all surfers.
And when was your first time there?
95, fall of 95, right when I moved to the San Francisco area from Florida, of all places, and paddled out first time and didn't catch a single wave. Sort of looked, kind of, you know, checked it out and go, okay, this looks interesting. I think I can do this, but, you know, you sort of have to feel it, and I didn't feel it. In fact, I went out two or three times before I actually caught a wave. But when I finally did catch a wave, it was like, oh my gosh. I mean, it was, you know, not a big wave. I wasn't deep in the pit. I was on the shoulder, but it was, you know, the kind of rush like you would get nowhere else in the world.
Ever experienced a scary moment, either riding or watching another surfer there?
Oh, many. I've watched many people get seriously hurt. And I myself have, you know, anybody that surfed Mavericks for any length of time can tell you all kinds of horror stories of nearly drowning, of you know, dislocating ribs. I dislocated a shoulder, you know, water. So when you're moving at speed, water turns into concrete. You say, oh, you're just going to fall off your board. You hit water. How bad could it be? No, not if you're falling 50, you know, let's say you wipe out on a, you know, 15 feet up in the air and you start falling, you hit the water. It's like hitting concrete, and it can break knees, shoulders, bones, you name it. It happens.
I always think of big wave surfers as analogous to free solo climbers in the world of mountain climbing.
That seems like a good analogy. It's also like extreme skiers hucking themselves off of, you know, cornices. It's all kind of the same thing. Extreme sports at the upper levels.
Well, let's talk about the more cerebral part of your experience. You run a really interesting website called Storm Surf. When did you first get interested in doing that? First, tell us, what is Storm Surf?
So stormsurf.com is a website dedicated mainly to anyone that's interested in the ocean and the science of the ocean, waves, storms, wind. It also dabbles in some snow snowboard forecasting, but mainly it's dedicated to big wave surfing. And so wave models, buoys, buoy forecasts, wind models, you name it, it's there.
And when did you first get interested in weather and its applications to surfing?
So when I lived in Florida, even when I was young, you know, we were in South Florida, and the usual drill in the summer was hurricanes would head towards the coast. And there was a lot of, you know, mobilization of resources to protect life, property, you know, evacuate people so they didn't get flooded, whatever. And, you know, when you're 7, 8, 9 years old and everyone's kind of in a panic trying to get out of the way of the storm. And in this day and age, they didn't, you know, they had satellites, but they didn't have anything like the modeling technology that we have today. So you never really knew what was going on up until about a day beforehand. And then you had to scramble to go, you know, evacuate, board up the house, whatever it may be. So it sort of left a lasting impression on me, and just the science of weather and all that sort of thing.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation with surfer and wave forecaster Mark Sponsler. Then we'll hear a conversation between Bruce Jenkins of the San Francisco Chronicle and oceanographer Bill Patzert. It's going to be great. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And we're back. Let's continue our conversation with surfer Mark Sponsler. His website, StormSurf, helps predict wave conditions for surfers. What's it like forecasting mavericks? How difficult is it to forecast? Because it only really breaks their big occasionally in the wintertime, right? What's it like to be able to forecast that?
So mavericks is a tricky place to forecast because, you know, it's more than just there has to be big waves. It's got to be, there's got to be big surf. It has to hit during daylight hours. The tide has to be right. The winds have to be right. And so you're juggling, there's multiple components of it. It's not just tracking the storm that's going to generate the swell, figuring out how big the swell will be, what the period will be, which relates to how quickly it moves, and then when that swell will arrive. But then it's, well, what's the swell going to, you know, what's the tide going to be like when the swell arrives? What direction is the swell going to be coming from? West, northwest, or north? Okay, and that all has an effect on how the wave breaks. And then, of course, what's the wind going to be? It's, you know, and trying to do that 2 or 3 or 4 days in advance, you know, so you get some sort of a sense of when you want to be there and when's the peak of the swell going to hit and when's the best window, you know. And typically, you know, you can be out there if you have a boat and try to surf from sunrise to sunset, but your arms and your body just can't last that long. So you want to pick about a 3-hour window when it's going to be best. And you only have one shot to do it. It's a long paddle from the beach out there. And, you know, you got one chance. So you got to pick your window, go, and hope it's the best. And so that's kind of what all this, the technology of modeling and forecasting and building tools to forecast that. It's all about trying to position yourself in the right place at the right time to get the best and biggest wave.
What's the biggest misconception you think people who don't surf have about surfing?
That everyone's just a bunch of hippie stoners and, hey, brah, it's all cool and all that. The reality is, at least in the big wave surfing world, it's that couldn't be further from the truth. A lot of the guys that surf mavericks on a regular basis, they're all professionals. They all have a good science and meteorology background. They're all in great shape. They don't smoke. They don't drink a whole lot. They certainly don't do drugs, and they're very focused on their sport and making the most of it and getting the, you know, making the most of their lives and using this as a way to fulfill or sort of be the center place, the anchor for their life.
Is there one moment you could, if I would ask you, your finest moment as a surfer, the thing you just, this was my favorite moment of my surfing life. Do you have one?
The problem is I've got so many of them, but I'll say as you get older, your memory starts fading and it all just turns into a blur. And so there are, but every now and then you get a good picture of you surfing, right? And so you end up remembering the picture. And so I've got out of 22 plus years of surfing mavericks, I've got what I call 2 good pictures. And I remember both of them very well. And, you know, there's something I can hang on my wall and always when I get old and can't surf anymore, I can look back and I'll go, I remember back in the day when I got that wave.
Hey, Mark, it was really fun to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Anytime.
Next, let's listen to a conversation I moderated between Bruce Jenkins and Bill Patzert. A longtime sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, Jenkins grew up in Malibu, son of the musician and arranger for Frank Sinatra, Gordon Jenkins. His father took him on a cruise from California to Hawaii, where he fell in love with the world of big wave surfing. Patzert, recently retired from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, also went to Hawaii as a young man to study oceanography and surf the big waves. Both have lifetimes of experience in and around the world of surfing. Bruce Jenkins and Bill Patzert, welcome to Blue Dot. Well, I'd like to start out, you guys kind of have something in common. Tell us about briefly what, let's start with you, Bill, about how you first came to Hawaii. And then I'd like to hear the same story from you, Bruce.
Well, my Hawaii story starts in 1965. I just graduated from school in the Midwest, and I'd always dreamed of being a surfer. And one cold winter evening, I found a coffee book on surfing in Hawaii. And I moseyed over to the graduate catalogs, and I saw there were starting a program in oceanography. And of course, the rest is history. And spent 7 great years surfing the North Shore.
That's outstanding. I'm sure you know Ricky Grigg. The late Ricky Grigg was an oceanographer out of Southern California, and I got to know him over here. But my Hawaii experience started in 1958. I was 10 years old, and my dad, who was a very prominent musician, he really knew how to take vacations. He took our family and another family to Hawaii for like 6 weeks. We sailed over on the Matsonia, which was a week of shuffleboard and consomme and ocean water swimming, and I think it was maybe 5 to 7 days, something like that. And by the time it's over, you're really ready to hit land. But we were in the Waikiki area in 1958, which is interesting in retrospect.
Yeah, I know. You know, Ricky and I were great friends. When I was in graduate school in Hawaii, he was in graduate school at Scripps.
Right.
And of course, we became fast friends. We did a lot of diving together. And I left Hawaii and became part of the faculty at Scripps. And of course, he went to the other way. He went back to Hawaii. And so we carried on our friendship for decades. He was a fantastic athlete and a great guy.
Yeah, he really was. I wrote the introduction to his biography, and I got to know a lot about him. Great diver, great paddler, and you know, really legendary big wave rider all up and down the North Shore. He had a great place right on Sunset Beach, looking straight into the break, and that was his training ground and where we went out and had some fun. Good guy. We miss him.
Yeah, no, he's he just didn't use enough sunscreen, you know? That's the trouble with all his hollies.
Yeah, absolutely. So my introduction to the North Shore was back in 1974. I've been reading about it for years. I never missed a copy of Surfer or Surfing magazines from the moment they came out, and it was really attuned to the whole lore of Pipeline and Sunset and Waimea. And in January of 74, I finally made it over here. I stayed a month, and that started a pattern that still lasts to this day. I think I've only missed 4 winters since 74. Coming over here for at least 2 weeks, sometimes six or seven, and it never fails to delight.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I read your book, North Shore Chronicles. It's one of the great classic surfing books. You know?
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, somebody said you're the Jack Kerouac of, you know, surfing writers.
I think he'd had a few pops before he said that. The reason I got interested in writing about surfing, you guys, was an incident that happened to me. It's in North Shore Chronicles. I got hit by a rogue wave in the middle of the night in a little cottage that basically just exploded on the impact down at Keiki, where the shore break is really fearsome. And this was a rogue wave during a huge swell, and it literally destroyed the place that I was sleeping in. And I remained inside and somehow came out alive. And up to then, you know, I'm a sports writer. I always had no problem talking to Magic Johnson or Joe Montana, but these guys over here, you know, the big wave riders over here, they were my real idols, and I always wondered, what the heck would I even say to them? I'm in such awe of them. But all of a sudden, I had a story to tell. They were like, oh, that was you? I mean, oh, my God. That's one of the biggest waves in the history of the North Shore. So inadvertently, I got on the map there.
So that rogue wave actually took out the cabin, the place you were staying in?
Totally destroyed it. They had to rebuild it. That particular beach, you probably know this, Bill, in 69, they had probably the biggest swell ever to hit over here, and it took a house on that same area and basically moved it across the street. Just kind of relocated it.
That's fantastic.
Bruce, you better explain to those of us out here listening, who's the Duke? Who was the Duke?
Well, Duke Kahanamoku was a native Hawaiian who really was a very influential figure in the sport of surfing. Really, the history of Hawaiian surfing goes back, some say, to the 15th century. There's evidence of waves being ridden, but it really wasn't until the early 20th centuries that some really significant strides were made. And Duke was he was an Olympic champion swimmer. He was a wonderful man, an ambassador who traveled the world, And it was his trip to Australia in around 1915 that basically introduced surfing to Australia. And if you I haven't been there, but I mean, if everyone says you go there now, surfing is it's like our football. It's so popular. The beaches are jammed for the contests, and all the breaks are crowded. And it's just considered a highly reputable sport over there, an honorable sport. And that was all. It all goes back to Duke Hanamoku in the 1915.
At this point, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about two things. I'm going to talk to Bill in a separate segment we'll do later, but I want to know about the men who ride these monster waves, and maybe some of the favorite ones, some of the personalities that you've encountered over the years. What is it that makes someone want to ride a mountain of water like this that could kill you?
Yeah, that's always been the appeal to me about riding, about surfing, is about giant waves and the people who ride them. And I find most of the time there's a tremendous humility about them. They're not so willing to trumpet their accomplishments. They're ready to go out there without any cameras or any documentation of what they do. Until recently, and really still to this day, there's no money in it whatsoever. I mean, we always talk about the comparison to golf, where you could have a guy who just had 6 chili dogs and is 25 pounds overweight standing over a 4-foot putt for like $1 million. And these guys are paddling out, you know, to the distant reefs. You can't even see them, riding 30 to 40 foot waves, and nobody has any idea what they're doing for no money, but the love of it, and, you know, and the confidence that you can do it. The real thing about big wave riding isn't so much the ability, but the ability to withstand the worst case scenario, where you're down for too long and you come back up and there's more waves that are going to send you right back down, and to be able to stay calm under those circumstances, which is absolutely inconceivable for most of us, even those who've surfed our whole lives, to keep your wits about you and not panic, which is the worst thing you can do. It sucks up all your oxygen and you probably won't come back. But so that is just an amazing sense of calm of these guys when things go wrong. That's what really separates them, because they can be out there. All of these men and women have had situations where they thought it was it. That this was, they weren't going to come back, and they were basically saying their farewells, but they come back and think about things and get right back out there.
Yeah, basically, they're loners, and what you find is that they're driven by some sort of an internal fire, because a big wave surfing or surfing over a shallow reef is really, you know, like Bruce says, it's life threatening. And they do it with a calm, and, you know, there's a lot of injuries in surfing. People don't realize, but these are very driven individuals, and your body has to be tuned at such a high level is that you have to live it every single day. The body has to be tuned, all right? Yeah. Your balance has to be just right, hardly any of them make any money. So, you know, a lot of them are sort of like gypsies.
Yeah. I think about guys like Derek Dorner or Roger Erickson. You know, they've got a – you can almost tell by looking at them on land that they're up to something very important that you don't quite know what it is. There's sort of a heaviness about them. And they don't really talk much about what they've done out there. Roger Erickson was a Vietnam veteran, and he just was sort of, you wouldn't see him, and all of a sudden Waimea Bay would be breaking at maximum size, and there'd be Roger Erickson out there getting a couple of the good ones. You know, same with most of these guys who ride the really big waves. You may not be terribly aware of them, and then they're just living for that time when everybody else is, you know, stirring up coffee or making a sandwich.
Yeah, you know, there have been casualties. You know, Mark Fu, you know, he was a world-class, world-champion surfer, lost his life at Mavericks. There's an example.
Absolutely. And another great surfer from Hawaii, Cyan Maloski, died at Mavericks on a big day. A guy named Donnie Solomon died at Waimea. one of the really hard-charging guys, underground guy, but everyone knew him in Hawaii, Todd Chesser, tried paddling out on one of those indescribably big days to an outer reef here on Oahu and didn't come back. And these are all real, you know, the absolute top-of-the-line guys. So you're right. I mean, nobody's immune from the ultimate worst case.
I'd like you to, Bruce, explain to us the history of Mavericks, because it's such an amazing place and it has such an interesting history. And when I watch those waves, they're frightening looking to me. And so I'd like you to discuss a little bit about the history of Mavericks and that place and how it became known, because it was unknown for so long. And then perhaps also, Bill, you could, you know, talk a little bit about why those waves are so big there, because it's unusual for California.
Highly unusual. And, of course, Mavericks has always been there. But as you're driving along Highway 1 in either direction, you don't see it at all. You might see a little bit of whitewater out there, but it wouldn't occur to you to take a look at it. And if it did, you still wouldn't be able to see it, because when you walk out there and you're finally on the beach, there's a big pile of rocks in front of you, and it's so far out and you're at sea level, you just really can't. You might catch a little glimpse of somebody on a wave, but you have really no idea what's going on out there. And the bluff is controlled by the Air Force and heavily restricted. There's a little spot where people can walk up and kind of get an idea, but you can't really see it very well from land. And it was basically discovered by a guy named Jeff Clark, who's a local Half Moon Bay guy who loved big waves. And he'd walk out, I guess in the days before the Air Force was super restrictive, he'd be out on the bluff and he'd see this giant wave out there, nobody taking it on. And, you know, just, I mean, sharks, it breaks way out to sea, the water's freezing, everything that surfers, you know, dread. Was it all packaged up into this one wave. And amazingly, it sounds crazy to this day, but he rode that place basically by himself for like 15 years, from 1975 to around 1990, because he couldn't get anyone to go out there with him. This is like a, you know, Mount Everest, conquering Mount Everest kind of thing. The magnitude of what he was doing out there, especially with nobody around. I mean, nobody goes out there now without a safety vest, without a jet ski to come pick them up if they get in trouble, without a photographer to document it. And he was just out there by himself riding these super scary waves. And finally, in around 1990, he got a couple of guys from Santa Cruz to go out there with him, and it was documented, and people started to take notice. And Santa Cruz is a big wave capital in California. There's some of the breaks there, Steamer Lane and everything. It's one of the best big wave breaks in California, but doesn't measure up to Mavericks in the slightest. But there was a group of guys from there who started to come to Mavericks, and there was a group from San Francisco, Mark Reniker and John Raymond and Grant Washburn, and they were sort of the first out there. And then Surfer Magazine did a piece, and boy, that changed everything, because the photos were absolutely mind-blowing. People couldn't believe it was California. And on a good day, you know, if you're a big wave rider, you could definitely see yourself out there and being able to surf it, especially if you had some, you know, somebody in a boat or a jet ski or whatever who could come get you and got in trouble. So that's kind of how it started, but it's still a bit of a mystery because you can't really see it. I mean, people are always asking me when they come out to Half Moon Bay, well, where do I see Mavericks? I go, well, first of all, it only breaks a few times a year, but even if you were to go out there, you wouldn't really be able to see it. So it's you have to... You almost have to surf it to know it.
Yeah, and of course, going back to first principles for some of the listeners, all these great waves are really generated by giant storms in the North or South Pacific or by hurricanes. And the size of the wave is really determined by the strength of the storm, how large an area it blows over, and the duration of the storm. And, of course, these storms create little waves of a few centimeters and then very, very long waves. And the interesting thing about storm-generated ocean waves is that the longer the wave, the faster they travel. And so with satellite technology now and wave models, we can actually forecast when we see a giant wave either off New Zealand or off the Aleutians, we can almost predict when these very long, smooth swells that generate these giant waves are going to arrive at particular locations. And so sometimes as much as a week ahead of time, they can forecast the waves, for instance, at Mavericks or some of these places like the North Shore on Hawaii. And surfers will fly in from all over the world and be there out there when these first very long, fast-traveling waves arrive. And so now it's with the advent of satellite technology, you actually can see these things and track these great, I call waves the great travelers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes waves generated in the Indian Ocean will actually make their way to the shores of California. And so it's a high science now.
Yeah, it really is, and it's such a blessing for big wave riders to be able to see ahead of time where they'd like to be and have the time to get there. And you can only you can't help but admire the guys in the old days. I mean, over here on the North Shore, I don't think anywhere in the world the surf comes up as quickly and dramatically as it does here. And without any kind of forecasting, you could be out there, and all of a sudden this big swell starts to hit, and you could get in some massive trouble. I mean, there's a long history of that here. The lifeguards would tell you. But the modern technology makes it possible to look ahead. The Mavericks contest people have a 72-hour advance notice that they've seen enough of the swell and weather patterns that they're pretty confident 72 hours from the call that it'll be a good day for the contest.
Well, we're about out of time, Kahuna. I should just say my two kahunai, if I can pluralize kahuna.
Okay, Dave, now remember, there's a lot of little guys out there, too, that surf. There's millions of weekend and weekday surfers that do those 6 to 10 foot waves, you know, guys like us.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
What really generated the interest in this show was that they're trying to generate the endless summer license plate from the state of California. And so all us old dudes, you know, can have a surfer license plate. But everybody's got to sign up and promise to buy one. And I'm looking forward to my surfer license plate and thinking back 40 years ago when I was out at sunset and it was topping 20.
Yeah, well, that's about as that's when you really know you're alive.
So tell us, you know, real briefly about the Bruce Brown's epic film The Endless Summer. Tell us about how people can find out about that license plate, because that's a real thing and people need to pay attention to that if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think you could post it up on the website with the podcast here on Blue Dot, where they could go in and vote for the license plate. And it sounds like an awful lot of fun. You know, I want to go out with a surfer license plate.
I'll sign up.
I know we just lost Bruce Brown recently, and I know for me as a kid, you know, whenever that movie would come on, they would show it in L.A. on TV occasionally. I was always in watching that one.
Well, it was just so well done. It's amazing how well it holds up today. Bruce Brown's narration was very clever and knowledgeable and witty and really just perfect. And they had a lot of luck, you know, traveling around the world. They found a wave in South Africa that was every surfer's dream. This perfect, not too big wave that went forever, and they were surfing it, and everyone watching is just like, oh. And then of course they had the great Hawaii footage, but it was just it was so cleverly put together that it sort of it was far superior product to a lot of surf movies that were just sort of hastily thrown together and edited and whatever music, and that's really all people needed to watch a surf movie. They didn't care. But Endless Summer reached a much, much bigger audience.
Yeah, you have to remember that was 1964. And
yeah,
I can remember in the mid-70s, still watching Endless Summer at the La Paloma Theater in Encinitas. And they had little platforms alongside the theater. And we would bring in pizza and six-packs and smoke dope. And watched Endless
Absolutely.
Summer. Endlessly.
Yeah, For me, it was the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. Lots of marijuana smoke in the air, and lots of hooting and hollering, and all those old movies finished with the classic pipeline sequence with Jerry Lopez in the tube. And boy, you talk about setting off some dreams among California surfers and anyone who wasn't in Hawaii. Like, boy, that's it. That's the ultimate.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Bruce Jenkins from the San Francisco Chronicle and Bill Patzert, formerly from NASA JPL, I hope you guys enjoyed talking to each other.
Oh, I sure did. It's great talking to you, Bill. And Dave, thanks so much for asking.
Okay, and a great book. I enjoyed it, and nice talking with both of you guys. Aloha.
Aloha, Bill. Aloha, Dave.
Thanks to Bruce Jenkins from the San Francisco Chronicle and our oceanographer emeritus, Bill Patzert. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlum. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll visit with Frank Huarte, staff photographer for Surfer Magazine and Big Wave Water Rescuer. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlum. Our next guest is Frank Huarte. Frank's a staff photographer for Surfer Magazine, but while taking pictures of big wave surfers, he's also prepared to rush in and save their lives on his personal watercraft. He and his friend Jeff Clark, who happens to be the first person to surf Mavericks off Pilar Point in Half Moon Bay, formed the Mavericks Water Patrol after the death of Hawaiian surfer Mark Fu in 1994. Frank Huarte, welcome to Blue Dot. I'd like to know a little bit about, first of all, what you do. You ride on personal watercraft, better known to most folks as jet skis, and you help pull surfers out of places like Mavericks, where the surf is really big, when they get in dangerous situations. And you also do photography there, right?
I do.
So I'd like to know, first of all, how did you get that gig? Like, how did you get to be where you are today? Give us a short history of your background, what led to this.
Basically, you know, I'm a lifelong surfer. So I was always around the ocean. My parents had a houseboat up the lake. So we're always on the water, always on jet skis. I was a lifeguard at the local pool. And then I went on to get my ocean lifeguard certification. And that didn't turn out to do anything. I went in the Air Force and, you know, started my career. Then I came back to the city and I linked up with Jeff Clark and I got out on, and I was assisting him and Grant Washburn, kind of just board caddying for those guys driving their Zodiac around out at Mavericks. And then the Zodiac was in such terrible shape that watching, like, there was like one or two guys that had jet skis, like photographers, Doug Acton, a couple other guys. And I'm like, man, I really need to be on a jet ski. So, but I always told myself, if I'm going to get on a ski, I'm going to go do rescues, because other people had been doing it, you know, long before Mavericks ever, you know, started doing it. So I just told myself, if I ever got the chance to get a jet ski and get out there, I would just do it. So, and I did. And that's exactly what happened. Jeff and I bought a jet ski for my brother. And then Jeff and I just started training on it. And here we are 21 years later.
And then how did that get combined with photography? Because you're a staff photographer for Surfer Magazine.
So at the time, before the jet skis came around, I was on a boat and Surfer would be, you know, they'd always be in contact with Jeff and getting photos and whatnot. And they asked him, they just said, hey, you got anybody on your boat taking pictures? And he goes, I got my friend Frank, you know, we could probably come up with some. And he goes, I have a camera. Jeff had a camera, a 35mm. And we kind of got off a couple shots and they published one of my shots. And then that got a little bit addicting. So I started talking to the pros that were out there, like Don Montgomery and a guy named Vern Fisher from Santa Cruz and Doug Acton from Half Moon Bay, you know, just kind of tapping their knowledge. And they basically trained the monkey, right? So they just told me which buttons to push. And, you know, I just started learning how to take photos. And, you know, since I was going to be out there already on the back of a boat or a jet ski, I might as well take some photos since I'm, you know, have a front row seat.
What's the most important thing you learned about getting a great surf photograph? Because you have taken some really awesome ones.
I think it's my friend Doug taught me. He just said, don't really focus on the surfer, because you know when the surfer is going to do it, because you're a lifelong surfer. You know what he's going to do, but watch the wave, right? So watch what the wave does, because that's what's going to make that photo more dramatic. So that's what he taught me how to do. You know, just watch the wave instead of the surfer. The surfer's going to do what he does, but the wave's going to do something completely different. The surfer's going to ride down the face of the wave, but it's what the actual wave does behind him is where the real photo comes through. So that's what you're looking for, you know. And you can see it, you know, being out there. And I'm on the Big Wave World Tour, so I get to go around to all the spots now. And you can just tell, you know, when it's going to do something spectacular, it just has that look to it. I can't even describe it, but it's just something about it.
You just know it when you see it.
You just know it because you've just been out there for so long. You know, it's like anything else.
Okay, well, I would like you to take us into the anatomy of a rescue and tell us about, you've been involved in some pretty dramatic and hairy rescues where your life was in danger. I think I saw one case where you had to go in and save a surfer and then your jet ski got damaged and you actually lost it, right?
It happened a couple times, yep.
Could you just describe what that's like going in there to save somebody like that? What is the water conditions like there? Just give us a visual of what does that look like for you going in there? Because, you know, a lot of people don't understand what that must look like.
And again, like the photo, like the photography, it's the same thing. You can see it happening long before it ever happens. Like, you know that if somebody goes on that wave, it's going to be a wipeout and you're going to have to probably go do a rescue. And it usually depends on the size of the wave or how quickly the wave is moving or the direction, right? So sometimes we'll go out there and a big wave will knock somebody down, but they'll pop right up the back. And then the other times it'll wash them all the way into the inside. And that's when you have to go get them before they get in trouble, you know, some real trouble. So, you know, for me, when I have my photo gear with me, I'll watch it. I'll know it. I'll even take the pictures of it. You know, my camera takes 10 frames per second. So I can get off a few shots before that wipeout happens. Stow my gear, kind of cruising nice and slow because he's definitely going to be underwater for a minute, and kind of just predict where he's going to come up. And all you have in front of you is a big foamy whitewater mess because, you know, 40, 50 foot wave breaks, all it does is aerate everything in front of it. So you try to drive this jet ski or personal watercraft through this stuff. Those things need to suck water underneath it and shoot it out the back. That's what propels you forward. You get into 3 foot of soupy, foamy, aerated water, you're not going anywhere. And that's where a couple times I've gotten clipped because it just, I mean, there's been 50 times where it's hit, but you can ride out of it because as soon as the bulk of the wave hits you, you can accelerate because there'll be water with you. But if it doesn't ever grab the jet ski, you know, the pump, you're done, and that thing's just going to sit still, and you're going to pay your dues right there. And it's not a happy moment for you or your jet ski or anybody involved, actually.
And you make it sound pretty nonchalant, but it sounds terrifying to me.
And it is, because you see it coming, and you know you're going to get hit. So you just, in a split second, you go through your drills, you know, because we practice risk management in our safety drills, you know. It's that's the most important thing, actually. It's, you know, we don't go in if we know we're not going to get out. But, you know, maybe one out of 100 times you go in thinking you're going to get out and you don't. So, yeah, those thoughts go through your mind. Okay, now what am I going to do? All right, I'm going to hold my breath. I'm going to inflate. You know, we have inflatable vests now. If I go too deep, I'll inflate my vest. My radio is waterproof. I can call for help. You know, you just go through all the motions. Cover your head to the rocks so you don't hit the rocks. Because unlike a surfer, you don't have a surfboard connected to your ankle almost pulling you back up. You're not tethered to anything. And so you go straight to the bottom. That's where you go as a rescue guy. And then you have to swim. You have to kick off the bottom and swim your way to the top. And it's hard when you have a couple waves on top of you. It's just dark. It's the pressure of those waves hold you down. It's scary, you know. But you don't think about the scary part. You just, because you know with your training, you're going to make it back up. So,
what was the most difficult rescue or the time maybe you felt closest to, I might lose this guy?
I think, it's happened a lot. But what happens is like multiple guys will go down. And you have to assess who's in the most trouble in another split second. And, you know, because at Mavericks on a normal day, there's only two or three guys, if at best, doing volunteer rescue. There's a bunch of guys on jet skis, a bunch of photographers, but they won't go in. There's only two or three guys that have the skill to go in and do it. And it's tough. Like, you have to choose. So these three guys are down and you have to choose which one. And it may not be the guy farthest in. He may be able to pop out the other side. It might be the guy in the middle. So you have to kind of assess that really quick. And there's been some just really hairy moments where you pass up a person to go get another person and then try to get the other person on the way back out. And it's tough. You know, it's hard. When you have a tight interval with a swell, any rescue's hard because the next wave is going to be chasing you down. So you go in there, you have to time it just perfectly. You pick up that guy. If he doesn't grab onto the sled the first time, you just have to get out of there and leave him because the next wave is coming so fast and so furious, he'll just get mowed down. You know, you're not going to help anybody having – that's the risk management part where now you have a surfer – and then you have a rescue guy and a jet ski floating around and they're getting, you know, then everyone has to be rescued. So
I'm thinking that, afterwards and beforehand, those guys better be awfully nice to you. Because they are. You don't want to tick off Frank if he's the guy that is going to choose between you and another guy to save your life.
And it's not like that out there. It's a really tight, you know, there's a lot of guys surfing out, but it's a pretty tight community. We all just take care of each other. That's what we do.
Thanks to all of our guests, surfer and wave forecaster Mark Sponsler, Bruce Jenkins from the San Francisco Chronicle, our oceanographer emeritus Bill Patzert, big wave surfer, photographer, and lifeguard Frank Cuarte, and musician John Biscuti. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow me on Twitter at Dave Shlom. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.